Who doesn't want to be happy? Everyone wants it, even if everyone has a different idea of what happiness is. Is happiness getting what you want? Thomas Merton famously said that people are not unhappy because they can't have what they want. People are unhappy because they don't know what they want. Oscar Wilde made the comment that there are only two tragedies in life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting it. The latter is the real tragedy. And the Rolling Stones sang, "I can't get no satisfaction." Will the Stones ever be happy? Rough crowd. There is an assumption lurking behind our notions of happiness that it is at least possible to be satisfied, and that such satisfaction will bring rest and peace. Yet we also know, if we have been paying attention at all during the course of our lives, from the youngest of us to the oldest, that such happiness is always beyond us, just over the rainbow, that green grass on the other side of the fence, in the form of the perfect neighborhood, or the ideal house, or that sports car that we've had our eyes on, or that handsome person with the beautiful face, kind, great body, and a stable career. These wonderful things, ideal neighborhood, perfect house, dream car, or the person of our dreams, if we could only have them, we would have satisfied the desire in our hearts and we would find peace. We have learned that the lottery is just a disguised tax on our stupidity because we have been playing it. And that is how we know it to be true. We are engaged in the world. Just so, when we did attain what we thought our heart's desire was, that desire disappeared. Not because we got what we wanted, but because what we thought we wanted wasn't what we wanted at all. We got buyer's remorse, discovered that the perfect 10 with the beautiful physique, enough intelligence to impress Alex Trebek, and kindly soul of St. Francis of Assisi, was in reality a con artist and made fools of us, and that the ideal house that we bought had undisclosed issues at closing, which only became apparent when we discovered 2 feet of water in the basement. Thus, the desire for peaceful rest never wanes, because the object of our desire cannot be realized. We don't know what we really want. As Augustine says to his God in Confessions, "Our hearts are restless, Lord, until they rest in you." For Augustine, real rest can only come in eternity, in other words, after death. But for us humans living here below in space and time, eternity is just one more unattainable object of desire as long as we are living. We come to understand that the desire itself is not a having, nor is it a being, if you will. Rather, it is the living journey going unsatisfied and propelling us toward the other, toward transcendence, toward what else there is in life besides satisfaction. We learn that the activity of life itself, which is not a consummation of a contract, such as a closing on a house sale, nor the arrival at a final end, which could only be death anyway, life is itself desire. That is, if we have acquired wisdom, we have learned that the journey is the goal. Desire itself is life. Such desire is anathema, perhaps, to the Buddhist, if misunderstood. But to be fair to the Buddha himself, he viewed desire quite differently than how we are looking at it here. The Buddha saw desire as one and the same as the things desired. Even the desire for nirvana in Buddhism is forbidden, insofar as nirvana would be thought of as a thing. In Western philosophy, we call this reification, that is, turning an idea into a thing. The Buddha was correct in saying in his reading of desire, that desire itself must be extinguished in order to reach enlightenment. Now, having made this caveat, let's continue with our very Western notions. Peace is like happiness. We would like to come up with a formula for world peace, and that is certainly desirable. But coming up with a plan, like President Wilson's League of Nations, would make peace just one more project of control and a manufactured object to frustrate our good intentions and slip out of our grasping hands. This cannot work because peace is not a grasping. It is grasping's very opposite. Peace is the desire for the other person as other and to remain other. It is welcoming the other as not me, not my desire satisfied, but my desire recognizing its own emptiness and only to be filled with the other's need, not their surplus, but their poverty. Their hunger and their thirst are calling to me as a vocation to live in the shame of my responsibility for their misery. My desire is therefore deepened and intensified by the need of the other person. Consequently, peace is not achieved when everything is in balance, like the age of Aquarius, when we all just get along with each other, because in a perfect balance, there is no longer desire. Aquarian time is an age when need has been abolished. Such an age, if it is supposed to take place here and now in this world and not in Augustine's eternity, is an illusion. Desire, life, and the other can only exist in time, and time is certainly not an illusion. The eternity of the now is an illusion, despite the insight of Eckhart Tolle, because the now isn't a point at rest. There will always be need, and there will always be desire. Jesus of Nazareth said it very plainly, "The poor you will always have with you." Poverty and scarcity are a part of life and the movement of time. Yet peace will arrive here below, not as an achievement or an acquiring, not as a plan, and not as a balancing act. Peace will only come from my desire for the other. And therefore, and here it comes, folks, are you ready to hear this? Peace will only come at my expense. My checkbook is out of balance, and I'm at the end of my rope. It is in my despair of ever being in the black on the bottom line of my accounts that I am called to ethics by the face of the other person. Ethical desire is never satisfied because there is always the other. The other is separated from me by an infinity that cannot be bridged because she is other. The face of the other person, which is an epiphany and not a phenomenon, which heralds the goodness therein, shines forth from that separation and lays an obligation on me whether I like it or not. I can only respond to the other's need out of my own poverty, or I can turn my back and make excuses. Either way, the ethical obligation remains. Peace is responding to the other as other than me, as one who has no obligation to reward me for my goodness, nor an obligation to say thank you. In my welcoming the other as other, there is no chance for a balance of power. The good of ethics is itself sovereign. It takes no prisoners because it doesn't involve military tactics. It admits of no reasonable treaties. Primordial goodness is prior even to evil. Now, in the book of the prophet Jeremiah, the reading, second reading today, we find the saying, "The people cry peace, peace, when there is no peace." Jeremiah says, They have treated the wound of my people carelessly, and yet they were not at all ashamed. They did not know how to blush. The people talk, something people are good at, saying, peace, peace. But they act shamefully, and they don't even have the decency to blush at their shame. The project of war is violence that wants to make the other into me. Or to say the same thing, war seeks to destroy otherness, to eliminate the other person precisely because they are other, the stranger, the alien, the unknown neighbor. Thus, the object of war is to quench desire and make it go away. Rather than welcoming the other, I try to understand the other, hoping that if I can just figure them out, I will dispel their alien eeriness. War is born from the same with a capital S. People are simply so many pawns in a war. Troops are alike, all alike. That is why they wear uniforms. Armies discourage personalities because a personality is what makes a person. Basic training and boot camp are designed to break down personalities, not build them up. Did you catch the implication of Jean's disgust with Leper in the reading from the novel A Separate Piece? Jean shouts at Leper, an appropriately named character, by the way, that Jean doesn't want to hear about Leper's disastrous experience in the army. Jean shouts, "What does this have to do with me?" Jean didn't understand that Leper's story of craziness was something to hear, to listen to, and not to comment on. Leper didn't ask for an editorial on his pain. What happened to Leper in the first reading is the result of an anonymous force being laid on someone with a name, someone unique, as we all are, anomalies. We don't even qualify as numbers. On the other hand, nothing remains unique in an equation because everything has to be reduced eventually to A equals A. War balances all equations precisely to extinguish desire. Desire is life, and life cannot succumb to mathematics. War seeks death. Even so, we believe that our peace treaties produce balanced equations in order to dispel the need for war. Yet this is why peace treaties ultimately fail. They presuppose the balancing act that started the war in the first place. I would insist that notions of peace, which are based on the maxim that we only fight wars to bring peace, has it all wrong. It's a little crazy, isn't it? Isn't that crazy? Maybe Leper was right. He's not crazy. The war is crazy. There is a wise saying, truth does not fight against illusions, nor do illusions fight against truth. Illusions battle only with themselves. Peace is no illusion, and it is manifested in the welcome of the other person as strange, as alien, as neighbor, as teacher, and as mentor. Our desire for the other person is the very breath of life and the very pain of giving birth to peace. Amen.